The Last Word on Today FM with Matt Cooper.
I'm delighted now that we're joined this week for the Culture Club by one of Ireland's most excellent thriller writers, and her new book, Our Little Cruelties, is out now. Liz Nugent, thank you very much for taking the time to join us. And before we start going through all of your choices, which I'm really looking forward to letting our listeners know about, just tell us a little bit about your new novel, please. What's it all about?
Well, it's about three brothers who have a very, very dysfunctional relationship with each other and with their mother. And it's how they grow up. It starts off at a funeral, and you know that one of the brothers is dead. And the question to be answered throughout the book is which brother is dead and which brother killed him.
Nicely put. You love a good story, don't you? All your books are really great stories, as well as having the great twists in their tale.
Well, yeah, I need there to be full of incident, you know. So that's this book takes the place over the span of about, you know, 40 or 50 years, about the span of my own lifetime, actually. So I just looked at the periods of, you know, of events that happened, like the Pope's Mass would have been a big thing when I was a kid. My first time going to Slane was a big thing when I was a kid. You know, all of those kind of, the equal marriage referendum is such a huge deal when I was an adult. You know, all of these kind of things played into the book, so I could just pick random years throughout those lives, throughout these three men's lives, and see how it might have affected these three very different men who grew up in the same house with the same parents and the same education, and yet turned out to be radically different characters in their own way.
One of the things we love about doing the Culture Club is that we find out the influences of many artists. And you mentioned Slane, and that we'll get to that when we get to the gigs. But let's start with music. And we often ask people, just as an indication, what if they can remember or admit to the first single that they ever bought. What was yours?
Well, oh God, I'll admit first, because it was, I think it was the first one that was ever bought for me, was a birthday present from my little brother, who was terribly sweet, James, and had bought me a single that I had really liked when it was on Top of the Pops. And I was probably about 12, 13, and it was called Pass the Dutchie on the Left Hand Side by Musical Youth. And he bought it for me a couple of weeks later for my birthday. But by then it had it was totally uncool to like Musical Youth. So I totally scorned it and kind of went, God, why do you think I'd like that? That's awful. I was so horrible to him, and I really regret it, because actually it is a good song. I still have the single. I still have all my singles from when I was a kid. So I played
all the 7-inch singles. Do you still play them?
Yeah, from time to time. Yeah, I have all my albums from my teenage years. I have tapes as well, and they're like, I have nothing to play them on, unfortunately. A lot of kind of bootleg tapes, obviously, and then the ones I actually bought. And see, I like to have the physical copy. I don't download much or Spotify
stream
much. I like to have the old CD. You know, I like to feel that I own the thing and that I'm not just renting it. So, yeah, all the stuff I have on tape, I will eventually end up trying to get on CD.
If Pass the Dutchie on the Left Hand Side is the first single you admit to having, given that it was given to you, what's the first one that you claim to have bought?
The one that I bought was Old and Wise by the Alan Parsons Project. Now, it's a
very mature choice for a teenager.
Well, I don't know. I just really like the melody. And I don't know. Actually, I never even looked up who the Alan Parsons Project was since. So I don't really know anything about them or who Alan Parsons was or is. I don't know if he's still alive. I don't know anything about him at all. But, you know, it was one of those things. We had a record player in the house. Oh, probably from, we were the last people. We were the last people to get, you know, colour TV. We were the last people to get a record player. And I think we had one in the house for about 4 or 5 years before I was allowed to go near it, because my brothers were in charge of the record player. So when I was probably 13, I'd say, I bought that single, Old and Wise, because I just thought the melody was absolutely gorgeous. And I played that recently as well too, and that stands up to the test of time, so I'm quite proud of that one.
Let's hear a little bit of it. That's the Alan Parsons Project. Now, we asked you to nominate a favourite album. For many people, it's really, really difficult to narrow it down to one. So just give us sort of a clue as to what was in the running before you made your choice, please, Liz.
I could have chosen 20. So Emmylou Harris would have been up there, Wrecking Ball, Radiohead, The Bends, any cello suites by Bach, Skunk Anansie's album, Joni Mitchell is... any number of Joni Mitchell albums I could name, but I honed in finally on Closing Time by Tom Waits. It's a very old album. I think it was produced in 1973. And I only became aware of it, I think, when I years in a former life, I was a stage manager on Riverdance. And so, like, when we were touring all over America and Canada, everybody, like, bought their own music system or, you know, Ghetto Blast or whatever. We would all buy CDs. And so we all kind of shared our musical influences with each other. And I can't remember which member of the crew or the band or one of the dancers or somebody introduced me to Tom Waits anyway and that particular album. And it's... there isn't a duff track on it. Like, all of the tracks on it are absolutely brilliant. Martha is probably my favourite. But there's a kind of a slightly drunken, hungover Sunday morning feel to the album. The piano is ever so slightly out of tune. There's a bit of saxophone. But I think it's when Tom Waits was at his most melodic. And... I think it's a super album. Really brilliant.
Let's hear Martha.
Now I was always so impulsive. I guess that I still am. But all that really mattered then was that I was a man. I guess that our being together was never meant to be.
Martha by Tom Waits. Liz Nugent is with us for the Culture Club, one of Ireland's leading thriller writers. You've picked the Cranberries as your favourite band. Why so, Liz?
When you asked me about this list, I kind of realised, and I left that question to last because I realised nearly all of the choices I made were to do with men, and I was determined to pick a band that was fronted by a woman. And I looked through my shelves of albums and the Cranberries stood out as a band that just brought me back to a time and place in the kind of early to mid 90s, I suppose, when I was living in a flat in Rathmines. I was living independently. I was single. I was free. I'm sure at one stage I might have sung Zombie on the top of a table in a bar somewhere with a gang of friends. And, it just reminds me of good times and happy times and free times and being young. And, I think that's why I chose the Cranberries as my favourite band.
Well, let's hear a little bit of the one that you used to sing from the top of tables, Zombie. Cranberries and Zombie. You mentioned, Liz Nugent, at the outset that in your new novel you make reference to going to Slane. And I love the description you've sent us of your experience of the best gig you were at, Bob Dylan in Slane in 1984, when you were just what age?
15.
And you went with your best friend, Marianne.
Yeah, we were both big Dylan fans. Well, we thought we were, but in fact, it was just that we were going to Wesley and all the cool guys really liked Dylan. So we decided, since the cute guys liked Bob Dylan, that we would also like Bob Dylan. So we had two albums each. We bought two albums each and then we swapped them and we learned all the lyrics off. So we were probably very young to be going to see Bob Dylan at age 15, because most of the audience would have been either male or older. So we thought when we got there that we would find people, that we would probably find the cute boys that we knew from Wesley, but we didn't. And so we thought we might be kissing boys and that they might share alcohol with us. But neither of those things happened. But it was still a tremendous day because we were grown-ups on our own. We were allowed to go. We got the bus that morning down to Slane. And of course, there had been some rioting in the village of Slane the night before. And when we came back, we told everybody that we'd been in the middle of the riot. But in fact, we'd got the bus down that morning. We were ferocious liars at the time. So, we had a fantastic day. It was amazing. UB40 played support. And it was the summer of Red, Red Wine. Remember that song?
Yes.
And
yes.
We had never, I don't think we'd ever tasted red wine, but, in those days, like if you drank at all, it was Pernod and black. So, we didn't get into any trouble. We didn't get up to anything. And I think because we couldn't get our hands on any booze, we kind of pretended to be drunk. So we were probably really annoying to everybody who was around us.
And was Bob Dylan any good on the day?
At the time, I thought he was amazing, but looking back, he was not in the best of form. you can get a good Bob Dylan gig and a bad Bob Dylan gig. I've seen him several times since, but we got a bad Bob Dylan gig. He didn't communicate at all with the audience. I think at one stage he said, "Are you all enjoying yourselves?" And the crowd went absolutely wild. And then he turned around and I think he said, "I wish I was." I don't know.
Oh,
I may have imagined that. But I think that was certainly the vibe I got from him, that he wasn't enjoying it and that he could have been anywhere, and he didn't care that 60,000 of us were there to worship at his feet. And we kissed no boys, and we smoked cigarettes, and we sat in the grass, and we were quite starving because we couldn't afford the probably £5 hamburgers from the expensive stalls or whatever. But and we probably walked miles to get into it. I don't remember that much. I mean, it's a long time ago and I'm very old. But
you're far from old. We're going to move on now to movies. And you've made a really interesting selection as your favourite movie, because it would be one of my favourite books, which I've never actually watched as a movie. Perfume, The Story of a Murderer.
Well, I have to agree with you. The book is shockingly good. Because the book is so much about the sense of smell, I better explain a little bit about what the book is about first. It's about a serial killer who murders beautiful young women in order to capture their essence, their scent. And what he does with their bodies, it's really gruesome and creepy. He embalms their bodies and then he scrapes the essence of the embalming fluid off them and distills that into a perfume. And he is forever trying to perfect this perfume making. He's a perfumier, but he was born in really awful circumstances under a fish stall. So he has this unbelievably heightened sense of smell. So when you read the book, you would think it was unfilmable because so much of it is about the sense of smell. But the director, who also wrote the screenplay and composed the music, this genius called Tom Tykwer, a German guy, adapted it so beautifully that you can almost smell what's going on. It is so viscerally done in the sort of the gruesome scenes, and so stunningly beautifully done in the beautiful scenes that you might as well be using all of your senses. It's just, he used quite natural light, so like every frame of it is almost like a Caravaggio painting. It's absolutely stunning. If you haven't seen it, I mean, if you've read the book...
You sold it to me now, Liz, because as I said, it must be 20 years ago I read the book. It's an absolutely fantastic book.
Yeah.
And I wasn't even aware of this movie. Who's in it?
Ben Whishaw plays Gorwi. Dustin Hoffman plays the perfumier under whom he trains. And Alan Rickman plays the father of the final young girl, the most beautiful girl, who is desperate. Like, towards the end of the film, the whole of France knows that there's this serial killer on the hunt for beautiful young women. And this father, it's set in, you know, pre-revolutionary France. So it's all very beautiful and visceral and lots of nice frocks and gowns. But also the street sewers of Paris, and you know, it's so visually stunning. I really highly, highly recommend it.
Well, let's play a clip from it.
What were you expecting to smell?
Glass.
But glass doesn't smell.
Of course it does. What's this?
I don't smell a thing.
Basta! It should smell like copper!
Enough! You were trying to distill the smell of copper, iron, glass, copper. What else did you try?
No.
Madonna Mia, have you gone completely insane?
You told me I had to experiment.
Experiment? Experiment?
But not with the cat!
What kind of a human being are you? Don't you know anything? You can no more distill the scent of a cat than you can distill the scent of you or me.
You can't.
Of course not.
Let's move on, because that was Dustin Hoffman. You've picked Al Pacino as Sherlock in a performance that you saw in Central Park as your best theatrical experience. Tell us about this.
It was probably about 10 years ago, and through a friend, I was able to get tickets to Merchant Venice in Central Park with Al Pacino playing Shylock. Now, Merchant of Venice would not be my favourite Shakespeare play, but the way this was told, because Al Pacino was playing Shylock, it changed the whole angle of the play. So it was about Shylock, and it really exposed the play for the anti-Semitism that is in it. And it was really slanted slightly from Shylock's point of view as the man who was hard done by. He had made a bargain and he wanted his pound of flesh, and that was the deal that was made. And, you know, why shouldn't... It was like, I think I saw it around the time that Ireland was in recession, and it really kind of struck me as, you know, the bondholders who demanded that we pay them back despite the fact that we were on our knees and we had nothing. It kind of told the story from the bondholders' point of view, if you get me. I know, yes, this isn't very sympathetic, but they even put in a little visual scene at the end of the play that is not in Shakespeare's script, but it was non-verbal. So the rest of the play was absolutely faithful to the script, but it's just the scene where at the end, Shylock's punishment is to be baptized as a Christian. So it's not dramatized in the actual play, but in this version it was, and they forced him over to a pond, which has been ever present in the set all the way through the play. And you wonder, you know, why is that pond there? But then you realize at the end they forcibly baptize him in the pond, and then they all leave the stage, and then he crawls out of the pond and grabs the yarmulke and puts it back on his head, and the entire audience has this wave of sympathy towards Shylock, which you wouldn't normally get without that scene. And it was really, it was a powerful, powerful experience. I saw a lot
of...
We
have an audio clip of it as it happens.
Oh, do you?
A lot of that particular scene. We do have some of that performance from Central Park. Indeed, I'm told that if you listen carefully enough, you can even hear the planes flying overhead.
Okay.
He hath disgraced me, hindered me 500,000, laughed at my losses, mocked at my gains, scorned my nation, thwarted my bargains, cooled my friends, heated mine enemies, and what's his reason? I am a Jew! Hath not a Jew eyes? Hath not a Jew hand? Organ, dimensions, senses, affections, passions, fed with the same food, hurt with the same weapons, subject to the same diseases, cured by the same means, warmed and cooled by the same winter and summer as a Christian is. If you prick us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? If you poison us, do we not die? And if you wrong us, shall we not revenge? If we are like you in the rest, we will resemble you in that.
High drama from Al Pacino in The Merchant of Venice. I didn't realise that you had worked on staging in Riverdance before you became such a successful thriller writer.
Oh, yeah. No, I was a stage manager for years. I worked for about 15 years. I worked as a stage manager in most theatres in Dublin and kind of internationally touring with Riverdance. Yeah, all over.
We better get to books in the time that we have available to us, because you are best known as a thriller writer. If we asked you again, it was probably unfair, like asking you to name a favourite album, but can you give us favourite books? I believe you've picked one as an adult and one from your teenage years.
Yeah, I think my favourite book as an adult would have to be A Fine Balance by Rohinton Mistry, an Indian writer, about two very poor tailors and juxtapositioning their lives of absolute misery and penury with that of a middle class student. And my favourite book as a teenager was probably Jaws by Peter Benchley.
Jaws? I think everyone thinks of that as a movie, don't they?
Yeah, I was too young to go and see the film, so I read the book. I wasn't allowed in. It was under 12s or something, or over 12s, or maybe over 15s. And I don't know what age I was when I read it, but certainly I was too young to see the film, whatever age that film was. So,
well, actually, I think we have in the past played clips from Jaws the movie. Let's have a clip from the audiobook of Jaws.
Great fish moved silently through the night water. propelled by short sweeps of its crescent tail. The mouth was open just enough to permit a rush of water over the gills. There was little other motion. An occasional correction of the apparently aimless course by the slight raising or lowering of a pectoral fin, as a bird changes direction by dipping one wing and lifting the other. The eyes were sightless in the black, and the other senses transmitted nothing extraordinary to the small, primitive brain. The fish might have been asleep, save for the movement dictated by countless millions of years of instinctive continuity, lacking the flotation bladder common to other fish, and the fluttering flaps to push oxygen-bearing water through its gills. It survived only by moving. Once stopped, it would sink to the bottom and die of anoxia.
Pardon the pun here, Liz, but is there more depth to the book Jaws than there is in the movie?
Well, I'll tell you what there is in the book that there isn't in the movie. Loads of filthy sex. And
oh,
I was
really?
Only, yeah. And I was so young when I read it that I kind of went over my head. It was only later when I read it again as an adult that I actually realized what was really going on. Yeah, because there's affairs going on left, right, and center between the, I think it's the sheriff's wife and the ship's captain. I can't remember now. But
what about the mayor of Amity, given that he apparently is now Boris Johnson's hero?
Well, yeah, you can see where he got that from. But late shutting the beaches, wasn't he? But it's a fantastic book. I think it's a good book for teenagers to read, but maybe older teenagers.
Right.
Let's
move on to your favorite TV shows in the time that we have left. And you're an enormous fan, I believe, of Breaking Bad.
Oh yeah, I use it as a teaching tool when I'm teaching, you know, how to write character. I show these students the pilot episode of Breaking Bad, which takes Walter White from a very mild-mannered, bullied, underconfident, undervalued, underrated chemistry school teacher and part-time car wash attendant to a meth cook, a cooker of methamphetamine, who can make an awful lot of money in one episode, in the pilot episode. It's just a brilliant study of characterization, and the whole, whatever, six or seven series of it, I must have watched it all about seven times, and now I'm watching Better Call Saul, which is the prequel to that. So I'm waiting until they finish Better Call Saul so that I can start from Better Call Saul from the very beginning and watch it all the way through to the end of Breaking Bad again. I am devoted to the life of Walter White.
Clearly, clearly. Yeah. We're just going to play a scene featuring Walt and Skyler in a storage unit being used to hold their drug cash.
I rented this place and I started bringing it here because I didn't know what else to do. I gave up counting it. I mean, I had to. It was just so much. So fast, I tried weighing it. I figured one bill of any denomination weighs a gram. There are 454 grams to a pound, but there's a variety of denominations. So,
how much is this?
I have no earthly idea. I truly don't. I just stack it up, keep it dry, spray it for silverfish. There is more money here than we could spend in 10 lifetimes. I certainly can't launder it, not with 100 car washes. Walt. Kids back. I want my life back. Please tell me, how much is enough?
Just finally, as we're out of time, just tell us a little bit though about the TV programs that influenced you from your teenage years.
Dallas, Dynasty, Starsky and Hutch, The Professionals, They were the ones that I loved. But and then in the summertime when we went to my granny's house, we were only allowed to watch Little House on the Prairie and the Waltons.
All great stories in there. We've run out of time, unfortunately, on this evening's Culture Club. But Liz Nugent, it has been absolutely great talking to you. Liz's new thriller is Our Little Cruelties.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Listen live, on air, from 4:30 weekdays on Today FM.